Hello, this is Janice Schweizer with the Pantograph for Tuesday, September 24th, 2024. We begin on the front page with IDOT seeks your vote. High-speed rail project that goes through Bloomington Normal up for National Transportation Award. A passenger train arrives in Normal from St. Louis on Monday morning at the Bloomington Normal Amtrak station. The Illinois Department of Transportation is asking residents to support its Chicago to St. Louis high-speed passenger rail project in the upcoming America's Transportation Awards. The rail line makes stops in Joliet, Dwight, Pontiac, Normal, Lincoln, Springfield, Carlinville, and Alton, connecting Chicago's Union Station and St. Louis's Gateway Station. The $2 billion upgrade allowed train speeds to rise from 79 miles per hour to 110, among other service improvements and amenities. Voting is open. America's Transportation Awards recognize projects and programs in a variety of categories, with Illinois' high-speed rail nominated for its influence on quality of life and community development. The three highest-scoring projects from each region will be named America's Top 12 and compete for a grand prize and a People's Choice Award. Winners are awarded $10,000 to donate to a charity or scholarship of their choosing. Also on the front page, we have State offers $75 million in rental aid. New program helps tenants struggling to pay rent and landlords. This is by Lizzie Kane with the Chicago Tribune. Illinois has launched its new state-funded court-based rental assistance program for tenants struggling to pay rent and their landlords, state officials confirmed. The new program, which opened Friday, follows a federally funded statewide program that assisted tenants who were facing financial hardship tied to the COVID-19 pandemic and at risk of eviction. The federally funded program, which began in October 2022 and was funded through the 2021 Federal American Rescue Plan Act, helped more than 10,500 landlords and renters in Illinois and stopped accepting applications in May as the funds were nearly exhausted. Rental assistance programs became widespread during the pandemic to aid the millions of renters who were struggling to pay their rent on time across the country, and many lost their jobs and got sick. Illinois allocated $75 million in state funding to continue to provide rental assistance to renters and their landlords for fiscal year 2025, which began July 1st. Unlike many other states and municipalities, Illinois made a significant allocation of dollars to continue the program. The rental assistance program is one aspect of the state's eviction diversion program, known formally as the Early Resolution Program. Landlords and tenants also receive legal aid to help settle eviction cases before they go to court. Michelle Gilbert, legal and policy director at the Law Center for Better Housing, one of the legal aid groups that is a part of the Eviction Diversion Program, had been routinely refreshing the website of the Illinois Housing Development Authority, the agency that administers the program, to see when the assistance would be available again for her clients. On Friday, when her page refresh finally produced the results she had been looking for, the program was accepting applications again. She emailed her clients, colleagues, and other tenant and landlord attorneys to share the news. While some of her clients had likely already been evicted, Gilbert said other clients whose landlords have been patient enough to wait until the new funds were available could receive the assistance. It's better to get assistance than to get an eviction order for both the landlords and the tenants, Gilbert said. Michael Zink, a real estate attorney who mostly represents small landlords, said he thinks that the rental assistance program has, by and large, been successful for both landlords and tenants. While the rental assistance program was on hold, some landlords remained patient, knowing more money was going to be available, while others simply couldn't wait anymore because they weren't able to pay a lot of their own bills, Zink said. He hopes the state considers funding the rental assistance program every year. It benefits everybody. It keeps people in their homes and helps people pay their bills who own these properties. For tenants who applied for rental assistance prior to the May application closure and were denied aid due to funding being exhausted, the Illinois Housing Development Authority will be reaching out and encouraging them to reapply, according to Andrew Field, an agency spokesperson. While the program was paused, IHDA continued working with the court system and legal aid organizations to halt evictions when possible, Field said. These efforts were to prevent displacement of the tenants and provide reassurance to the landlords the opportunity to recoup past due rent payments. Under the new state-funded rental assistance program, households facing eviction can receive up to $15,000 in rental assistance, which can pay past due rent, up to $500 in court costs, and up to 2 months of future rent, according to the state housing authority. Eligible tenants have to make 80% or less of the area median income and do not have to be facing a COVID-19 related hardship. Renters do not have to prove their citizenship status and must have an active eviction case due to non-payment of rent to qualify, according to the state housing authority. Housing providers will not be allowed to evict tenants during the grant's coverage period. For tenants whose landlords are unwilling to participate in the program, the state will offer up to 2 months of future rent payments to help them find a new place to live. The Housing Authority's goal is to assist 8,900 households through the new program. As of Monday morning, 260 rental assistance applications had been submitted with the state, according to Field. While most of the requirements are the same as when rental assistance was funded by federal dollars at its height, the federally funded program provided up to $25,000 in rental assistance to cover up to 15 months of past due rent and up to 3 months of future rent. In March, the maximum grant amount decreased to $10,000 and up to 2 months of future rent in an attempt to prolong the program, according to the state housing authority. Gilbert said she thinks the new limit will cover the vast majority of people in need of assistance. Renters who receive the maximum amount of federal aid allowed under the program will be eligible for the new state funds, but will not be able to apply for a second round of assistance if they don't reach the limit of $15,000. For more information about Illinois' program and to apply, visit IllinoisHousingHelp.org. In local news, we have ISU announces pair of Redbird beers in partnership with Distill by Brendan Dennison. Illinois State University has announced two officially licensed beers in partnership with Distill Brewing that will launch during ISU's homecoming games this weekend. Redbird Ale, which has been brewed by the Normal-based beer maker since 2007, and Battlebird Lager, a new brew, will make their debut under the official licensure at Friday's Redbird volleyball game and Saturday's Redbird football game. ISU's Deputy Director of Athletics, Paul Cabes, said the partnership gives the university's fan base a unique opportunity to support student athletes and local businesses. We're excited to partner with Distill to create two unique, locally brewed beers that bring together our fans, alumni, and community in a fun and meaningful way, said Matt Morin, General Manager of Redbird Sports Properties. According to the announcement from ISU, royalties from the beer sales will go to ISU to support a variety of initiatives, and the collaboration will give educational opportunities for business, marketing, entrepreneurship, art, graphic design, and other students to help build ISU's brand. Redbird Ale is an American red ale brewed in celebration of ISU Redbirds, described as having medium caramel malt sweetness leveled by hop bitterness, aroma, and flavor. Battlebird Lager is brewed in the style of a Munich Hell's Lager with a golden hue, delicate malt sweetness with light biscuit attributes, low bitterness, and subtle noble hop flavor. We're excited to partner with Distill to create two unique locally brewed beers that bring together our fans, alumni, and community in a meaningful way, said Redbird Sports Property General Manager Matt Morin. Fans aged 21 and up will be able to purchase these beers at Hancock Stadium and Sefcu Arena starting this weekend. Redbird Volleyball will first take on Murray State on Friday at the arena, and a Redbird football match will match up with North Dakota State on Saturday. Redbird Ale and Battlebird Lager will also be available at Distill locations. Soon, they will be available for retail purchase and at area bars and restaurants. Given Distill's roots in Bloomington Normal, founder and CEO Matt Potts said his team is thrilled to partner with the university for these beers and proud to support ISU and its student athletes. Danny Schroeder, Assistant Director for Trademark Licensing and Project Communications at ISU, said it's an honor to work with Distill on this new offering. We hope Redbirds near and far appreciate the nod to ISU's history and athletic traditions incorporated in the can designs created by university graphic designers Mike Mall and Evan Walls, Schroeder wrote in the announcement. Illinois Wesleyan University in Bloomington announced last week it will debut a custom beer, IWU Brew, in partnership with Distill, too. IWU Brew will be released October 5th as part of the Titans' homecoming celebrations. Brennan Dennison also writes, Clint Black concert coming to BCPA. A honky-tonk country western icon will be swinging into Bloomington early next year. Clint Black is scheduled for a February 15th show at the Bloomington Center for Performing Arts at 600 North East Street in Bloomington. Black is described as one of the truest traditionalists in the country music genre, taking inspiration from Merle Haggard, Willie Nelson, and Waylon Jennings. Black's career took off with the 1989 release of album Killin' Time, producing 5 consecutive top singles on the Billboard Hot Country chart. Early this year, Black embarked on a 15th anniversary tour of the album that continues into 2025. Tickets for his BCPA show in February start at $58.50 and go on sale at 10 a.m. Friday at Ticketmaster.com. For more information, visit artsblooming.org or contact the BCPA office at 309-434-2777. Next, we have 8 Hall of Fame inductees announced. Illinois State University is welcoming 8 new inductees to the College of Education Hall of Fame. In a statement, ISU said honorees will be recognized as part of homecoming weekend programs on Friday. Gerardo Jerry Barrio, undergraduate class of 1998, has a bachelor's degree in history education and a master's degree in special education from ISU. He holds a dual language social studies teaching position in Elgin's Unit 46 School District, where he has taught bilingual, special education, and English language students for 24 years. John Bierbaum, undergraduate class of 2005, has a bachelor's degree in social science education, a master's degree in history, and a doctorate in teaching and learning from ISU. He has taught at his alma mater, Normal Community West High School, for 2 decades and now chairs the social studies department. Tamara Foley, undergraduate class of 1980, has a bachelor's degree in special education from ISU. She also has a master's degree in education and a doctorate in special education leadership. Foley was an executive director of teaching and learning at a school district in Jonesboro, Georgia, until 2017. Trudy Gross, undergraduate class of 1992, has a bachelor's degree in special education from ISU. She also has a master's degree in educational administration and a doctorate in special ed. Gross is an associate superintendent of teaching and learning at the Fremont Union High School District in California. Lindsay Jensen received her doctorate in teaching and learning from ISU in 2020. In 2018, she was named Illinois Teacher of the Year and was later awarded a Harvard certification in family and community engagement. Diane Rindak, undergraduate class of 1974, has a bachelor's degree in special ed from ISU. She also has a master's degree and doctorate in special education. Rindak is a professor at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, and she has worked in the education field for 50 years. Dana Carricker, undergraduate class of 1985, has a bachelor's degree in elementary education and a master's degree and doctorate in curriculum and instruction from ISU. She is the assistant director of the Center for Integrated Professional Development at the Normal University. Tara Mathian, undergraduate class of 2003, has a bachelor's degree in early childhood education at ISU. She also has a master's degree in child development and administration and a doctorate in curriculum and instruction leadership. Mathian is a clinical assistant professor and leads early childhood studies programs at the University of Florida. From Sarah McCarrig with the Chicago Tribune, we have jury awards $750,000 to student hit with belts. By the time a federal jury delivered their verdict Wednesday evening, awarding Jomari Champ's family $750,000 in damages, the Chicago Public Schools student, who is now 15, had long left the courtroom. On the last day of a civil trial focused on the beating he'd endured as a fourth-grade Tilton Elementary School student, Champ had walked out early in closing arguments as lawyers debated the extent of his psychological injuries and the Board of Education's responsibilities for the actions of his former homeroom teacher, Kristen Haynes. Along the facts, not in contention, after Champ, who has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, was repeatedly disruptive in her class, Haynes allowed her personal acquaintance, who was not affiliated with CPS, Juanita Tyler, into the West Garfield School at the start of a late September school day in 2018. Haynes brought Champ, then 9, to a bathroom with Tyler and then left him alone with her there. Tyler, an estranged relative whom the boy did not know, proceeded to beat Champ repeatedly with two belts, which Haynes kept in her classroom. Board of Education attorney Brian Culp insisted that physically hitting children has never been a part of the culture at CPS, telling members of the jury it would not be just to hold the district liable. Representing Tyler, who was criminally convicted of domestic battery for the incident in 2023, lawyer Andrew Rima asked members of the jury to, quote, put your compassion aside, asserting that damages for which Champ's mother sought compensation were an exaggeration, attempting to pass off his lifelong struggles with ADHD to one day. The day was pure psychological terror for Champ, who was hospitalized twice following the incident and diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, which exacerbated his ADHD and for which symptoms remain with the now sophomore CPS student to the present day, according to a member of the family's legal team, Al Hofeld Jr., and a nurse who testified in the trial. In local briefs, we have Bloomington Public Library to be closed October 1st. The Bloomington Public Library will be closed Tuesday, October 1st, for staff development. The bookmobile will not make any stops during the closure. The library, located at 205 East Olive Street, is expected to reopen with normal hours at 9 a.m. on Wednesday, October 2nd. And the McLean County Highway Department will be closing County Road 1600 East between County Road 900 North and Pebble Road starting Tuesday. This stretch of road in Bloomington Township will be closed through Wednesday, weather permitting, for culvert work. For more updates about upcoming road closures or project extensions, visit mcleancountyill.gov/highway. Returning to the first page again, we have Civics Education is Gaining Steam. Professor, up to 65% of people born in the United States would not pass the citizenship test. This is by Alan G. Breed and Tim Sullivan with the Associated Press. On the first day of his American National Government class, Professor Kevin Dopp asks how many of his students are United States citizens. Every hand shoots up. So how did all you people become citizens, he asked. Did you pass a test? No, one woman says tentatively. We were born here. It's a good thing. Based on his years of making his students at the University of South Carolina, Beaufort, take the test given to immigrants seeking U.S. citizenship, most but would be rejected. 30-35% of the students will pass it, says Doff, a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel and former West Point instructor. The rest of them are clueless. I mean, they're just clueless. Most states require some sort of high school civics instruction. But with a recent survey by the Annenberg Public Policy Center showing that about a third of American adults can't name the three branches of the federal government, many think we should be aiming higher. Over the past few years, a small but growing number of states have begun requiring students at publicly funded colleges to complete a civics requirement. That comes as polling indicates civics education is wildly popular across the political spectrum. Civics, the study of citizens' rights and responsibilities, fosters a sense of unity, advocates say, and an ability to deal with disagreement. It empowers citizens, and many people believe it could help heal America's divides. Having it in higher education means they can look at issues in more sophisticated ways, perhaps weaving it into other classes. I feel we are in the business for making a case for America, said Louise Dubay, head of iCivics, which promotes civics education. But what does it mean when talking about civics often can't be, well, civil? Take North Carolina, where lawmakers and academics got into a heated battle over who should decide how civics would be taught. Last year, North Carolina Republicans introduced the REACH Act, an acronym for Reclaiming College Education on America's Constitutional Heritage. The bill required undergraduates to take at least 3 credit hours in American government and read a series of major U.S. history documents, including the Declaration of Independence. They would also have to pass a final exam worth 20% of the final grade. If the bill seemed anodyne on the surface, it met with intense pushback. Critics pointed to the bill's reclaiming title, its attempt to dictate curriculum usually set by professors, and that it was drafted by Jameson Brogy, an avowedly conservative U.S. Marine Corps captain and lawyer. The North Carolina Act easily passed the State House in March of 2023 and a first reading in the Senate, seemingly on its way to victory. But University of North Carolina officials and faculty were not happy. In the end, professors across multiple campuses worked together to draft a competing set of similar learning outcomes. The resulting proposal, called the, quote, Foundations of American Democracy, close quote, mirrors the REACH Act in many ways. The UNC Board of Governors unanimously approved the plan in mid-April. Details are still being ironed out, with the requirement applying to students entering the system starting in July 2025. According to the conservative New York-based Civics Alliance, legislation in at least 10 states, Arkansas, California, Florida, Georgia, Missouri, Nevada, South Carolina, Texas, Utah, and Wyoming require undergraduates at public universities to take at least one American history and/or government course. The requirement is being enacted or at least discussed in other states. And the Alliance, which rails against, quote, identity politics and, quote, radical new civics activists, close quote, is looking to spread the word. The organization has created model legislation that calls for, quote, the study of and devotion to America's exceptional and praiseworthy history, close quote. David Randall, the Alliance's executive director, said its materials had informed legislation in Florida, Iowa, and Texas, but declined to say what other states might have reached out. Some state college systems, like UNC, haven't waited for a legislative mandate to act. For example, students at Indiana's Purdue University and its satellite campuses can choose from three paths: write reflections after attending 6 approved civics-related events, listen to 12 podcasts and take a series of quizzes, or complete one of 13 politics or history courses and pass an exam. University of Arizona System faculty are currently developing American Institutions curricula to fulfill a requirement from the Board of Regents. Professors acknowledge not all students appreciate the forced civics learning. Some view it as the vegetable in a meal. Some view it as the dessert. For some, the goal is just to finish the meal. David Reingold, Dean of Purdue's College of Liberal Arts, who oversaw the implementation of the system's civics program. The Civics Alliance says America's colleges, which train K-12 teachers, have been, quote, taken over by radical establishment determined to replace proper civics education with pedagogies such as critical race theory and action civics, close quote. Whitney Ross Manzo, an associate professor of political science at Meredith College in Raleigh, says fears about political indoctrination assume a power that faculty simply don't have. If I could force something on my students, it would be to read their syllabus and do their homework. I don't have the power to change their political ideology, said Manzo, who once taught in Texas. Back in Bluffton, Doff has his work cut out for him. After some introductory remarks, he tells his students to take out a piece of paper and pen. This is your first test. The 14 questions are relatively simple. How many members in the U.S. Senate? What are the requirements to be president? How long is the term for members of the House of Representatives? Would-be citizens must get 6 of 10 answers correct to pass. Doff holds his students to a lower standard, just 7 of 14. And today's flick fact: when a joke bombs or is especially funny, a regular shtick on NBC's Late Night with Seth Meyers is for Meyers to literally attribute the joke to which of the show's writers wrote it, invariably including one of its head writers, Brian Donaldson. Before writing for Meyers, what was Donaldson doing? Now age 50 and 10 years with Seth Meyers, before that, Donaldson worked in IT at Country Financial in Bloomington, and in his spare time or on work breaks, posted jokes on Twitter, often deadpans about family, marriage, and aging. They got spotted by a producer on Meyers' show, and the rest is history. And that concludes the reading of Part 1 of the Pantograph for Tuesday, September 24th, 2024. I'm Janice Schweizer, and I will return shortly with Part 2.